Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, every area of scientific endeavour is somewhat competitive, but in the late 1800s, two paleontologists competed with each other so viciously that both were left ruined. Riley Black is the author of The Secret Life of Bones, and she joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Riley.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
So could you tell us about these two paleontologists? As I understand it, both were quite wealthy, so they were in a position to wage war on each other.
That's exactly right. So there was Edward Drinker Cope, who was based out of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, and Othniel Charles Marsh, who was out of New Haven in Connecticut, who worked out of what's now Yale University. And they had met as students in Europe because at the time that they were studying paleontology, there wasn't any paleontology program in the United States. They had to go to Germany and other spots in Europe to go learn their trade, and they became friends and they came back. But very quickly thereafter, they became the worst of rivals and basically devoted their careers to trying to outdo the other. Whoever could find the most fossils, name the most fossils, become the preeminent paleontologist in the US.
And is it fair to say that this particular period seemed to be a bonanza for dinosaur bones? It was just pretty much anywhere in the US, people were tripping over them.
Absolutely. And the weird thing was, I grew up in New Jersey on the East Coast, and people used to tell me there aren't any dinosaurs there. You have to go west to where I live now in Utah. But the fact is, some of the best early discoveries were made in New Jersey and on the East Coast. These articulated dinosaur skeletons that gave us an idea of what the whole animal looked like. Previous finds that had been made in England and elsewhere in Europe, they were, you know, you'd get a bit of jaw, you know, a bit of leg bone, but you couldn't tell what the whole animal looked like. The finds in North America, they started to really inspire people that these things are weird and there's probably a lot more of them out there. So as the push west began, people started finding these immense dinosaurs and other fossil animals unlike anything anybody had seen before. It was basically something that the indigenous population in the West knew about, that they had their own stories and understanding of these fossils. But to white scientists, they didn't really know anything about it at all. So it was this entire lost world in the West that Cope and Marsh were really competing over.
And because they were so literally thick on the ground, so to speak, that as I understand it, in those early days, it wasn't necessarily paleontologists or their students who were going out digging up the bones. They'd employ people to do it for them.
Yeah, so Cope and Marsh both had expeditions out west. I think Cope did a bit more field work than Marsh did. But eventually, they just spent so much time basically locked in their offices, you know, surrounded by bones that were coming in from the west. They just worried about the descriptions, that they hired other people to go out and look for fossils for them. And there's a little bit of that tradition today. It's not so much that paleontologists send people out for them, but it really relies on volunteer and student labor. So some traditions are still there.
And so this started when, and these two men were friends of sorts, originally, as I understand it. Marsh had found a cache of bones and invited Cope along to see how many bones he'd found.
It was actually the opposite. So Cope had an arrangement with a mining crew in New Jersey. They were mining this stuff called glauconite that's really rich in materials that are good for fertilizer. And as they were digging out these, this mineral, they kept finding all these strange bones, and they got sent on to Cope. And Cope was really proud of this. He brought Marsh along to see it. Marsh on the sly said, like, hey, I'll pay you more for the same fossils. And the fossils started going to New Haven instead of Philadelphia. And that was sort of the opening shot in this debate that really got solidified by when Cope unveiled this restoration of a marine reptile called Elasmosaurus. So tiny head, long neck, four paddles for limbs, kind of like if you threaded a snake through a turtle, kind of what you'd get. But he put the head on the wrong end, and this was pointed out in public. And from then on, he was just absolutely furious with anybody who criticized him, especially Marsh.
Right. And they would go to great lengths, would they, to trash each other's reputation?
It got to the point where there's a journal that Cope bought called The American Naturalist. So basically, he bought a scientific journal so that all his papers would have a place to say to go. And he hired the editorial board. And it got so vociferous between Cope and Marsh that they were sending out so many missives tearing at each other that the journal that Cope himself bought said, we are not doing this anymore. You cannot send papers that are basically just attacking your rival. If it doesn't have Scientific American, we're not publishing it. So there are a lot of legends about, you know, crews blowing up each other's bones that probably aren't true. But, you know, whoever was out in the field, all these people who are basically like freelance fossil hunters, sometimes they'd contact both and basically see who would get the better price and then send the bones to that person, which only fueled that rivalry.
Now, they both had money. Did they exhaust all the resources conducting this war?
For the most part, yeah. They didn't die destitute, but they spent the vast majority of what they had. This is something where especially Cope was gotten to some mining options that were in the West that didn't play out and didn't really provide a return. And Marsh just like was such a workaholic that there was nothing else. It's just like everything went into the collection of more bones, trying to amass this collection where we're still finding things from that era. They're still wrapped in the underwear of the field crews that came in from the West because they ran out of plaster to send it back in that haven't even been opened yet. So this was just this incredible acquisitiveness that they put everything into.
Oh, my word. And even at the point of death, that competition continued in the sense of the relative sizes of their brains.
That's right. So when Cope died, or just before his death, he stipulated that he wanted his skeleton and skull to be stored as well as his brain. His brain to go to somewhere called the Wistar Institute. And he basically threw this challenge to Marsh saying, like, you know, after you die, give your brain to science. We'll see who has the bigger brain. Because at the time, it was that just whoever has the bigger brain must obviously be smarter. And Marsh just never took the bait, which is kind of strange in a way because Marsh came up with this idea of how brain size gets larger over time and creates intelligence and things like that. But in any case, Cope's challenges went unanswered, but he was still trying to get at Marsh even at his last moments.
Now, I suppose the irony about this, the tragic irony about this, is that they did both contribute hugely to paleontology.
They did, and they really trained the next generation, the people who went back to various sites, you know, around Eastern North America, to Chicago and Pittsburgh and New York City. A lot of the people that they trained became the next generation of experts that set up what we call the second Jurassic dinosaur rush. So this big push out west to get these huge skeletons that you often see, you know, in museums and the big dinosaur halls and stuff. Because prior to that, dinosaurs were considered something for scientists only. Basically, there weren't dinosaurs on display. You couldn't go to a museum and see these skeletons. That only really began in the very early 1900s. So it was this incredibly destructive and difficult war between these two men that inadvertently set up the field to become what it is today.
At the time, because of the way they both conducted themselves, if they had conducted themselves with a bit more decorum, would we be a bit more familiar with their names?
You know what? I don't think we would. I think they're famous because of this, because the exact counterexample for this was someone who was involved in this saga, a Philadelphia naturalist by the name of Joseph Leidy, who actually described one of the first dinosaurs found in Eastern America, Hadrosaurus, you know, really important dinosaur. He was a polymath. He discovered all sorts of things, was super, super smart, and nobody remembers Leidy because he basically bowed out. He saw how hot this debate was getting and stepped away from it. So he's always kind of like the footnote to this contest. So it's something of a case where it's a double-edged sword, where these people created the field of paleontology as we know it, but they also set a really bad precedent for who a paleontologist is and the way to comport ourselves. In some ways, we still deal with some of those rivalries today.
Riley, thank you very much for speaking with us today. That was Riley Black there, the author of The Secret Life of Bones, Their Origins, Evolution and Fate.
Moncrief on News Talk.